From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last night in a small Iowa town when a precinct captain wanted to know why the reporting app for voting wasn't working. She asked the caucus manager what was going on. No one knew. Eventually, they decided to try to figure out the delicate allegations in longhand, and then they would just call the results into the state party. But when they finally placed that call, they couldn't get through. Two towns away, a caucus leader announced that the voting app wouldn't download. Precinct captains couldn't get the app onto their devices. They didn't know how to report results. Just hours before, the chairman of the Iowa Democratic Party told reporters that Democrats had never been so prepared for the Iowa caucuses. He boasted that this new system had been tested and was ready for the action. He was obviously spectacularly wrong. Amazingly, the app was created by a tech company called Shadow. Perhaps we'll get the results from Iowa this hour, and if we do, we'll share them with you. But this has been a national embarrassment at a time when Democrats are attempting to position themselves as the party that is unified or able to unify and certainly ready to lead. President Trump is at a field day with the Iowa mess. Pete Buttigieg declared victory. So did Bernie Sanders, kind of. And while Elizabeth Warren's campaign manager warned against anyone declaring anything, he swiftly followed that up with a declaration that Joe Biden had come in a distant fourth. Where do we go from here? Is it finally time to ask Iowa to move to the back of the line? Iowans frequently say that they take the process seriously. They vet candidates carefully. They have experience with this. They have long honed the skills required to lead this process. And meanwhile, a video clip has gone viral of an Iowa voter signing a card to caucus for Pete Buttigieg last night, only to then ask, on caucus night, why didn't no one tell her that he's gay? Pete Buttigieg is I live and breathe, a gay man? Yes. Yes, that woman was told he is gay. And she didn't know what to do. High information voters. Look, I'm frustrated today because I've said for a long time I have a bias in this. I'm a journalist. I'm also someone who cares about these processes. And I think that there should be a rotation of states. I've said that for a long, long time. I feel like maybe we're finally there. And we were not going to really talk about that this hour. But we should talk about that in some way. And then we'll talk about, well, what the party's going to do moving forward here. So things have shifted. And once again, if we get results from Iowa, we will let you know. Hello and welcome in studio to our guests. Jen Lunsford is an attorney with Seeker Sciortino and a current candidate for the 135th Assembly District. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Jeremy Cooney, former chief of staff for the city of Rochester, Democratic candidate for the 56th Senate District. Welcome to you as well. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here, Evan.
Patrick Coyle is a grad student and a political operative. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, look, I guess I want to start with this. Jeremy, did you know that Pete Buttigieg was gay?
I think I might have heard that
the next time somebody tells me Iowa voters have this sort of special skill that nobody else has in vetting candidates up close, I'm just going to send them that clip of that woman who was just shocked to hear it. Okay, but beyond that now, I'll start with you. Are we overplaying this mess, or is this a really, really bad moment right now?
This is a total mess. There needs to be some accountability when there are a lot of people who are watching their TVs or watching their screens and phones last night, waiting for some direction, who put in a lot of energy and a lot of money into the state of Iowa to get their messages honed and out there. And unfortunately, here we are sitting the next day with no clear indication of a pathway forward. That being said, I agree with you, Evan, that it is time for a change. I think we have some nostalgia. I think as a country, we pride ourselves on being the bastion of democracy, and we like the idea of people coming to a gymnasium and going to corners and coming together as, you know, in a caucus setting. But the practical reality is, how do you weigh that against getting more people to participate in the process, getting more people to vote when it comes to a general election? And the way to do that is to be more inclusive. And technology can be one of those mechanisms to encourage more people to participate. But clearly, in this instance, it didn't work. And, you know, we rushed through the testing process. And quite frankly, it's been a disappointment to everyone. Mm.
Jen Lunsford.
So I don't want to jump to conclusions about how this debacle reflects on the candidates who had nothing to do with this process.
Sure.
In a state with a caucus where people who have time that day to go stand in corners of school gyms for hours and hours, who have to publicly show their vote, who didn't have to work that day, who don't have childcare duties, the very, very small subset of the population in Iowa who is in charge of maybe not downloading an app for the first time 5 minutes before you have to use it, that this is not reflective of the entire Democratic Party, of the candidates who worked very hard, of the broader Democratic Party. This is a failure of the Iowa Board of Elections and the people who were not trained to use this program effectively. But I think anybody who's ever rolled out any kind of technology publicly knows that there's going to be problems. This was a particularly embarrassing issue, but I don't think it's reflective of Democrats' inability to govern generally because of how narrow an issue it is.
Okay, Patrick?
I just really enjoyed watching the last Iowa caucuses. Ever. There's never...
you mean the final Iowa caucuses?
No, I really can't imagine that we're going to sign up for that again. And I think Jen brings up the most valuable point, you know, and especially, you know, there's so many people, whether, you know, it's people, you know, who work the night shift, you know, whether it's people who have kids and may not be able to get childcare, you know, specifically by having a caucus rather than saying, hey, like polls are open from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m., like, you know, vote whenever you can by saying, you know, you have to be in this physical space, you know, for 3 rounds of voting in 2 hours. That's incredibly restrictive to a lot of people, you know, whose voices need to be heard. And so I think the whole process of caucuses is antiquated. And, you know, Iowa is obviously not reflective of, you know, the nation. And, you know, it just seems wild to me that, you know, huge parts of narrative and, you know, campaigns like Claim Momentum come from, you know, basically, you know, a bunch of people just going to various corners of a church basement, you know, on a Monday night.
Well, but Patrick, I mean, before this kind of mess went down last night, NPR had this story on satellite caucuses. So for the first time, they had, you know, three Iowan expats going to school in the Eastern European state of Georgia, and they had a caucus in the dorm room. And this sort of romantic notion that they were actually opening it up. You're arguing that this is still far too restrictive at a time where it's complicated to begin with, but it's really restrictive on who can be there?
Definitely.
Okay. So, Jen, you kind of made that point here, but is there anything that could save the idea of caucuses in general? Because this is not the only state that caucuses. Should we jettison caucuses entirely?
I really think we should. I mean, even the regular polls open for 12 to 16 hours a day model is restrictive to people. That's why we opened up early voting in New York State. And the idea that someone has to publicly declare their vote, as they do in a caucus, I think is also very restricting. Someone may want to vote in a way they don't want the world to know about, and that's why we keep voting secret in so many places. So there's a number of issues that come together in a caucus process that I think is fundamentally undemocratic.
But what about this notion that in Iowa this is almost a holiday of sorts? There's so much emphasis that there is a lot of work done to allow people to have the chance. I guess my response to that is, does that mean no hospitals are open? Does that mean, you know, there's no fast food joints open?
I
mean,
Walmart's not closed.
I mean, there's
schools
people who
like,
cannot be there.
Yep.
Yeah. Which is far too restrictive to begin with. Yeah. Very strange. But Jeremy Cooney, how do you feel about the sort of public vote declaration? Let me kind of offer a different take on this. Not my own. Will Wilkinson is a writer who's contributed to the New York Times, among others, and a policy director for the Niskanen Center. Really interesting guy who spent his earlier years on the Blogging Heads TV days as a libertarian, and now he lives in Iowa, and he caucused for Elizabeth Warren last night. And he said there is something beautiful about not just voting, but engaging publicly with your fellow citizens in a sort of a town square, talking out the issues and trying to persuade. He still likes that idea, despite the mess of the caucuses, which may be going away. Do you like that idea, or do you share the concern with public declaration of voting?
I share the concern. I think it goes back to that nostalgia, right? That feeling that we're a town square, mm-hmm. and we're having these robust conversations, and that people, the assumption there is that people are actually persuadable, right? And I think we as a society have become hyper-partisan, right? And, you know, the analogy I always use when this conversation comes up is the football field, right? We used to be at the 50-yard line, right? And now we're both, two teams are standing on opposite end zones, right? And no one's moving on the field, right? And so when you're in that situation, the us versus them situation of our American political system, the ability to persuade someone is very, and you know what? People are very passionate about their beliefs. Last night we had, Evan, we had a watch party for the Iowa caucus. And this was not for any particular presidential candidate.
You were hosting a watch party?
I was hosting, yeah.
What were you watching?
So we watched a lot of pundits on MSNBC, and it was a lot of talking. And then, of course, what I loved about it was it gave us an opportunity to talk about local and state politics, which I love talking about. But the point is, we had Buttigieg delegates. We had Bernie Sanders delegates. We had supporters of different campaigns wearing, you know, Warren swag. And we even had a Bloomberg person there, right? It was great, right? And they were all coming around because they were interested in seeing what was happening. I don't think that anyone was there to be persuaded. And if we were on opposite sides of the room that we were in on Park Avenue last night, I'm not so sure that we would have been able to move our folks over. So to answer your question, I think that I agree with Jen that the caucus concept is, I think, a little outdated. I do want to focus on how do we get more people to participate in the process. And, you know, whether it's a workplace or an educational barrier that allows participation or a health barrier, right? I do want to focus that if we want to get younger voters more engaged in the process, if we want to get a more diverse electorate, then we want to make sure that as many people have a voice in the process.
Go ahead.
I will say that there is something to be said about the caucusing process functioning effectively as ranked choice voting.
That's where I was going with it. That's like the best argument for this.
I agree.
That's the best argument for the caucus.
We could just have ranked choice voting in a poll booth, though. Like that, you could still do that.
Isn't that the plan for New York City, right? Didn't they just pass that this past year? So Maine, right?
Maine does.
State of Maine has ranked choice voting. And I think.
And some small municipalities here and there.
Massachusetts.
Correct. Right. But I don't think it's, you know, I think Berkeley in California has ranked choice voting as well. But again, I think we're going to start to see the ranked choice method, you know, open. The door has been opened to that. And I think we're going to see that come across the U.S.
Well, Jen, explain a little bit more here, because when you say you could just do it in the booth, for people who haven't caucused before, the 15% viable threshold seems mildly arbitrary to me. I don't know who created this idea.
Absolutely.
But if you don't get to 15% in your individual caucus site, then let's say you're a Yang supporter and you got 14%. You got a choice of going home and voting for nobody or caucusing with nobody, or you can now be persuaded to caucus with other people. And that's where the persuading does happen. And it effectively does become much more important who your second choice is, especially if you're supporting someone who's not in that viable threshold. I appreciate that. I do think it's interesting seeing that as an option. But you're saying you don't have to do it in gyms playing Red Rover, Red Rover.
Correct. I don't know that at the poll booth is the place to start persuading voters. Mm-hmm. If you want to have a robust public dialogue, there's been 2 years of active campaigning to do that. And I think standing there and saying, hey, your guy's out, we've got cookies over here, come on, Klobuchar's got it, then that's not exactly the most democratic way to approach it. I've been in college, I was part of the first year the student senate did ranked choice voting. And I lost. I got the most votes. And I was on the losing end of ranked choice voting. And I still believe in it because I think that it is a more democratic way to elect people than first past the post, which is what we call the kind of voting system we have now. Do people know what ranked choice voting is? Are we using jargon?
No, I think generally speaking, they do. I mean, why don't you explain what you think would be a simple, easy way? So you go into the booth to vote, and what are you given?
You're given a ballot with number slots. You can say, this is my first choice and this person is my second choice. And I think some systems even go deeper than second choice. I don't know that there's a ton of value in going through that. There's a number of countries that use ranked choice voting, and we can look to other states for their methodology. But if your first choice candidate doesn't reach some previously set upon number, in many places it's 50%, if they don't win.
An outright majority, not
an outright majority. Yeah. Then there is a second choice too. And there's different formulas for how you can do it.
Okay.
But the idea is that you don't have to choose all or nothing.
Yes.
Right? That if you are a diehard believer in Andrew Yang, right? But
poor Andrew Yang.
He's always the example there. But you know,
Michael Bennett erasure.
People are like, Michael Bennett. Okay, I think I've heard of him before. Right?
John Delaney.
Number 11. Yeah, well, he's out. John Delaney's out. So But okay, so you choose your candidate, right? And you say, but if it's not him, it's her. Or if it's not her, it's him, right? And it gives that ability to participate and to still feel confident when making a choice and maybe make a choice for an untraditional candidate, right? So it allows more third-party candidates or centrist candidates the opportunity to be able to be viable. And again, going back to what I said earlier before, we're kind of on both sides of the end zone, right? That we're hyper-partisan and we put forward our one choice and that's it. I will say, just a comment, one of the good things about caucusing is that it forces mainstream political candidates to actually have to do that grassroots work. And, you know, I'm looking at Patrick and Jen. We've all done these knocking on doors. We've all done that grassroots work. And to see someone like the former vice president of the United States have to do that.
But why don't you have to do that?
Because it's a lot of time. Look at New York, right? We're part of the Super Tuesday process, right? And, you know, we're obviously a big state and an expensive state. People will come in and dump a lot of money into ads and radio ads and TV ads and mailers, but you're not going to see them, right? And there's something really special about going to a gymnasium and hearing from a speaker if they're actually in the room and asking questions and saying, where are you on this issue? Or, you know, so that there is some more voter education.
I don't know if it's the caucus process that does that, though, as much as it being first.
Being first. Okay.
And being small. Because you can't do that in California or Texas. True. It's just too expensive.
But if let's just say in the next cycle, New York State is first, whoever's first gets the disproportionate number of visits that lead up. So the larger the state, it strikes me that a larger state should be first because you've got more time to get more places in the state. What do you think, Patrick?
Yeah, I think, and you know, if they made me in charge of the Constitution, which they haven't done yet, a national ranked choice primary would seem to make the most sense. You know, just, you know, because then you force people to campaign where the most people are, you know, and
one national primary day?
Why not? I mean, it's just, you know, if you were designing a system from scratch, it's very difficult, you know, that you wouldn't zero in on that as the most efficient way to do it, you know, because we're allowing, you know, the results of a caucus, you know, in Iowa and New Hampshire, two states that are not at all demographically representative of the you know, to determine these narratives about momentum and which campaigns are surging and
who
which
gets
are flailing.
What ticket out of Iowa?
Yeah.
You know, because 7,000 people voted and that determines who should be even in the race.
Anymore. Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, Obama was thought of as, you know, this, you know, like long shot candidate till he, you know, had the surprise victory in Iowa. And then he used that, you know, to slingshot his way to the nomination. But it just seems to me that, you know, we're giving disproportionate influence to states that don't necessarily represent, you know, who your average Democratic primary voter is.
Well, okay. But so I'll start with you on this. But I want to hear all three of yours. Give me their system. You are the ones in charge now of redoing this. And we're not doing Iowa first and New Hampshire second every time. I would have thought the natural thing to do is either have sort of a lottery, but a rotating lottery where it has to be spread out, or some kind of rotation. You're arguing for one day, same day national primary.
Yeah.
And I guess you would do it a little bit later in the year then.
Yeah. I mean, you could do it when, like, you know, congressional primaries are. Yeah.
Okay. Jen Lunsford.
This is probably me speaking as a candidate and thinking about Jeremy's nodding
exactly where that's going.
How intensely onerous that would be for campaigns to have to run two national campaigns like that, and to move, you'd have to move the primary later, and then the general would be shorter, which would give an advantage to a presidential incumbent. I think having more than one super day, group states in ways that are, and I think maybe nationally say it's not up to the states, and we might have a 10th Amendment problem with that, but group states, here are some rural states, here are some big states, here are some small states, here are some coastal states.
Do you do it in geographic groupings?
Maybe not even, but let's say California, Iowa, Georgia, New Hampshire go one day, and you have 5 or 6 days of states from different parts of the country,
okay,
so that you're not having two of our least populous states, two of our least diverse states, making decisions that influence the momentum moving into the rest of the country. I think that's the biggest issue with me for Iowa and New Hampshire, is that these are two states where the populations do not reflect what the Democratic populace or even the country's populace looks like. And that gives momentum to people who might not otherwise gain momentum if the first two states were Alabama and New Mexico.
Especially in a caucus environment. Like, I don't know if you guys saw, like, on Twitter some of the pictures of satellite caucuses, people who work the night shift. They did not look like the caucuses that were on CNN during prime time.
No, they did not at all. Okay, so what's the system?
One thing I would just add about the national one day idea is that the cost would be extraordinary. And what that – I've got a lot of thoughts on public financing of campaigns, but I'll save that for another show. My thought is that I want to encourage as many people to run for office as possible. And if there's a barrier of cost where they have to run a national campaign twice, as Jen said, that would effectively eliminate abilities to get messages out and present themselves as candidates. Now, maybe as technology advances and earned media and free media kind of are more available and more people are accessing that information, maybe that's a different conversation. But right now, I would hate to see good candidates not have an opportunity to get their voice out there and name out there because of the cost. I do like the idea, Jen, that Jen suggested of kind of grouping more Super Tuesday clusters. My only twist to that would be, what if we created clusters that were more reflective of the diversity of our country, so that it's not necessarily geographic clusters, but we're saying, okay, we're going to find different types of states, wealth-wise, racially, faith-wise, right, that really are kind of a patchwork of our American system. So that, again, it's not, okay, South Carolina, we know what that's all about, right? Or, you know, Iowa, we know what that's all about, right? This is more about what is the fabric of America and how can we find a president who can represent everyone in the system.
Yeah, I want to credit NPR, but I don't know if I'm correct. I'm trying to remember, in the last 48 hours I read, someone put together a list of 1 to 50 states that would be the most representative on a number of things: diversity, income. There was a number of factors that were listed. Illinois was at the top of the list for that. New Jersey was high on the list. And there were some states you wouldn't expect. I mean, Iowa and New Hampshire were not high on the list. So, yes, the point being, something that's a little bit more representative would make sense. By the way, New York State doesn't vote until April 28th. We're not on Super Tuesday. March 3rd, here's the list for Super Tuesday: Alabama, American Samoa, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Democrats abroad, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Vermont, Virginia. It's a lot on March 3rd. And you would assume we're going to have some clarity by then. One more point before I get some feedback from listeners on this. Well, actually, let me grab Sarah's comment here, because Sarah says, I'd really love to know the average age of the people who couldn't figure out the voting app in Iowa last night. I don't want to make sweeping generalizations, but I bet it wasn't millennials, Gen X, Gen Z. I don't know if that's right. I don't think this is a generational thing. Do you?
I'm actually going to say, I'm going to defend people. I am a person who has to use government apps for things, for the Workers' Compensation Board, for some other kinds of technology that the state has rolled out. And I'm going to blame the app before I blame the people, because there were people downloading this app right before they had – that's really the problem. The people were downloading the app as they needed to use it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I'm sure, like, there's updates you have to run, and then your account didn't work. And there was – these should have been rolled out weeks earlier. People – in the actual human beings who had to use them needed to test them.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things baked in here. But I cannot believe that you're a caucus manager and you're trying to download it like an hour before you have to use it. It took 90 minutes to get my son's Pokemon Go app going. I mean, there's just – you cannot. But – that speaks to the point where the lack of organization, that they didn't, they should have had test runs and rollouts, and I can't believe
it. They didn't test it.
What's that?
They didn't test it.
They didn't, yeah.
No.
But do you, Sarah is blaming older caucus managers, not the youngs. As the youngest of the youngs, what do you think?
Go ahead. Give me a tough spot here. No, I don't, I just don't think you should have used an app.
Don't need an app.
Pencil and paper works fine, you know? That's how they've been doing it. Do we have any issues in, you know, the last time we've had caucuses when there wasn't an app? No, it seemed to work fine.
Well, Charlie Worzel, writing for the New York Times as an opinion contributor, has a piece in which he concludes, move fast and break the Iowa caucuses.
Oh, yeah.
And here's what he writes. He says, the Iowa failure suggests a potentially deadly combination of techno-utopianism and laziness, and the two fuel each other. The overarching belief that software will fix everything leads to slapdash engineering, procurement, and deployment, end quote. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, that's the main grifting problem with Republicans is direct mail. And the main grifting problem with Democrats is, you know, these magical tech solutions. You know, I'm sure that some poor consultant, you know, some poor staffer, you know, took a meeting with a consultant who was like, this is the magical app and it's going to make everything better. And all you have to do is give me a quick $250,000. And then you know, the software guy was like, all right, guys, we got to make an app now. You know, I'm just sure that, you know, the process was relatively slapdash in a way that unnecessarily complicated the entire process.
Well, and by the way, producer Megan Mack confirms it was NPR that published a piece, The Perfect State Index, the PSI, under the headline, If Iowa and New Hampshire Are Too White to Go First, Then Who? Based on their PSI, a number of factors, not just race. They did have Illinois first. And later in the hour, if you want, we can take a look at some of the other states. But the bottom line is I think this may finally force it. This may be what breaks at least this rotational system, which Iowa has a divine right of kings to go first.
And can we just say that that's okay, right? That's okay. We're learning as we grow, right? Like we're
None
breaking
of this is okay.
it.
Okay, stop defending this.
No, but it's okay to change the system. We don't need to,
yes.
again, we don't
yes.
need to just like say, well, it was an app and that, you know, if the app was better and it, you know, people had downloaded it earlier, then it would have worked and the caucus system works. The points that we made around this table before still hold true. We're not being inclusive. We're not making sure that as many people can participate as possible. And we're not being representative of the country that this president, whomever he or she will seek to represent.
I also want to comment briefly on Patrick's point about procurement. You know, in many states, you have to go with the lowest bidder. And that when you deal with technology, as we saw with the ACA health exchange rollout, in situations where you are asking for web development and app development from the cheapest possible option, you're going to get the cheapest possible option. And we've also watched for the last 3 years as the federal government has ignored pleas from the states to please help us invest in technology that's going to keep our elections safe and keep our elections fair. And there has not been the economic investment at many state levels or federal levels that we need to move our elections into the 21st century.
Fair. And as we go to our only break, I will just say that a concern that I have just as a journalist who covers politics is faith in institutions is not high right now.
That's, yeah, just like any sort of perceived threat to the legitimacy of the election is it's just incredibly dangerous. And I just can't believe they didn't test the app.
Exactly. That's why when some have said, boy, are we overplaying this? I'm sort of two minds here. We don't have any reason to believe that anything's been stolen or rigged. This does just look like incompetence. And we're probably going to get the results any minute now, any hour now. And the results will be very carefully counted, and they will probably be accurate. And then we can move on, and all the focus will be on New Hampshire. And pretty soon, this will just be sort of like a little point to laugh at, like, Iowa's pulling its best Florida, you know, but whatever. However, Patrick's point's an important one. Every little crack in the public faith in institutions matters, particularly coming off 2016, and I'm not talking about the result of Trump's election. I'm talking about the concern of the reliability of the institutions that we should be able to rely on. This hurts that. And you don't want people laughing at your elections process. You don't want people feeling like they can't count on whether it works. It's already limited in terms of who can participate. But this is not the time for this, and I just can't believe they got this so wrong. Patrick Coyle, as just mentioned, is a grad student, political operative, and Jen Lunsford's an attorney with Seeger Sorrentino and a candidate for the 135th Assembly District. Jeremy Cooney is a state Senate candidate in the 56th District and a former chief of staff for the city of Rochester. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the path forward now within the party because, well, some of our guests have different bumper stickers on their cars. And I wonder if they're going to be able to unify about that. We're going to talk about that next. Coming up in our second hour, in a sea of writing and commentary since the passing of Kobe Bryant, there's one piece that stood out to me by a local writer who's also an engineer, a comedian, and an activist. Chris Thompson has offered more nuance in the conversation about Kobe Bryant and his life and legacy than most I've seen. I asked him to come in and talk about it, and we'll sit down with him next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I should mention that our guests in studio are three of the many people that we reached out to it's always good to kind of get a wide range of voices as we go throughout these elections processes. And we don't stack panels with supporters either way, but I am curious to know, because Patrick Coyle supported, I think, Bernie Sanders in 2016, obviously not in the general, but in the primary process. This time around, you had signed up to support Elizabeth Warren. You're back on Team Sanders?
I mean, as much as teams, like, if the primary was today, I'd probably vote for Sanders. But, you know, Warren is great. I think she'd be a great president. I've donated money to both candidates. I have no strong, that's my preference at the moment, but I'm not like, a diehard.
Okay. All right. Jen Lunsford.
I am a Warren supporter. I like a lady with a plan.
Okay, Jeremy Cooney.
I'm the person on the panel who doesn't have a bumper sticker that says my choice. I tell you, I was a Kamala Harris supporter. I think I actually mentioned that on this show before. But look, that the process played out the way it is. I like the attributes of each of the different candidates. My number one concern, making sure we take back the White House this year. We've got to make sure that whomever we're putting forth as a Democrat, that we're united behind she or him, and making sure that we win this White House.
Do you accept the framing of Kamala Harris as having been, to the extent that there's sort of a spectrum and a sliding scale, a more centrist candidate in this field?
Sure. I mean, I guess it depends on the issue, right? I think if you look at some of the criminal justice aspects of her, she's probably more centrist than some of the other candidates who are still in the race today. What I liked about Kamala Harris is that she was incredibly articulate. I think she could go head-to-head with the president of the United States. And I've liked to see what she's done in the Senate, and I'd like to bring her ideas from California across the U.S.
Before I get to the phone calls here, Jeremy, you've said number one is about unification of the party leading to November. Are there any non-starters in this field where you'd say, I don't think I can get there?
No. I would support whomever the Democratic candidate is for the presidency.
Okay. Jen Lunsford?
I would vote for a frozen bag of tater tots over Donald Trump. Literally anybody.
Patrick Coyle?
Yeah, I mean, I'd vote for the Democrat no matter what in November. But I mean, we live in New York. Doesn't matter.
I'm talking about, okay, fair. That's a fair point. But are there any candidates who would make you feel somewhat nauseated?
Yes. Either Bloomberg or Steyer, just for the fact that, I'm going to, take, this incredible sum of wealth that's beyond, 99.999% of the people who've ever lived, and I'm just going to use it to buy a vanity spot. That just does not seem like the way to select a leader of the free world.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Michael Bloomberg, because, we'll talk about his candidacy in the weeks to come, I'm sure, because some of the latest polling shows him now well into the double digits.
It's terrifying.
In the Democratic field. He has outspending. It's not just that he spent $200 million already. It's when you look at it compared to the other candidates.
Him and Steyer are responsible for 85% of the total money spent in the race.
Yep. It is really, really remarkable. And what I suspect could happen is Iowa's already a mess. You're likely to see, and I'm very careful saying this, but you're likely to see Sanders or Buttigieg with more delegates coming out of Iowa, declaring some kind of a victory. Perhaps Warren, we don't know. Then you're going to have New Hampshire. Most of the time, Iowa, New Hampshire, you got to win one of those two states to get a nomination. The last one who did not win either and got a nomination in an open process was Bill Clinton. So in the last 44 years, he's the only one. But Michael Bloomberg is going to come in and say, I'm well-funded. I'm here to stay. I have a track record in New York City, which is larger than most states. And you don't like the field, so I'm here, and I can beat Trump. He's going to do that, and it's already gaining some traction. You're nodding over there, Patrick.
No, yeah, it's inarguably working.
You don't have to like it, but you're saying
it's good. Yeah,
yeah, but that's just,
The guy who endorsed George W. Bush hosted the 2004 Republican National Convention. That's the guy.
Jen Lunsford, does that concern you, or do you think that hey, he's a Democrat, he's in the field, welcome to the field, and let's see the best candidate win?
I don't love someone coming in late, spending money, and running the numbers up over people who have been doing the work for 2 to 4 years. I always reward people who have done the work. And I think there is a element of shiny new object that happens any time a new person comes into any kind of field, and people get distracted by that. And I don't know how long that momentum carries. I think that there are a lot of moderate Democrats and independent voters, and I think maybe even some moderate Republicans, who like the appeal of a Bloomberg because they think that's the kind of person who can beat Donald Trump. In my opinion, if you can win the Democratic primary, you can beat Donald Trump.
I also think that aspect is sort of underappreciated too. You know, like we're just, you know, led to believe that like Trump's some sort of unbeatable political juggernaut. And it's, you know, you flip 70,000 votes split among three states.
It's true.
Yeah. And I know
six states or so matter.
Yeah.
And he polls pretty well in the swing states. And Pew, Gallup.
Gallup, yeah.
Has him at 49% national approval rating today, his highest number ever.
It's still a huge lift, but I don't believe there's massive differences among any of the top-tier candidates. I think they all have relatively similar shots.
I hear you. Gallup is not Rasmussen. Gallup is not an organization that's stacking an approval rating. 49% should concern Democrats who are serious about this. What do you make of Bloomberg, Jeremy Cooney?
I had a chance to actually sit down and talk with Bloomberg when he was mayor of New York. I think he's a very personable person. I think he's absolutely brilliant. I agree with Jen that there are those moderates out there and independent people who are more comfortable with a candidate like Bloomberg. But look, what I like about Bloomberg, and I have a lot of problems with billionaires kind of coming in and last minute buying their way into some approval rating. But what I like about Bloomberg is that he does actually have governmental experience, mm-hmm. and has executive experience. Mm-hmm. And this is an executive role. And to have someone who has dealt with big systems of bureaucracy in a very complex, overly regulated state like New York, and who got things done on behalf of New York City. Now, I don't agree with all of his policies, certainly, but who got things done and generally people are pleased with, right? In my mind, he's a qualified candidate. And, you know, he's got to make his case to the American people just like everyone else has. But I do like the fact that I think going head to head with President Trump, he would be a voice and a force that the president is going to have a tough time with. I really do.
Pennsylvania diners, they like their big gulps.
Yeah, he's the soda and guns guy.
Yes,
like,
yes.
But he is viewed as sort of a moderate. He has higher Q rating, or is more well known than most people who might try to pop into a race late. So
I'm going to say this: I'm from Long Island. We know Donald Trump down there. We've known him for years. We did not take him seriously as a candidate because we know he's a joke of a person. Mike Bloomberg knows Donald Trump, like really knows him. And I think that there is an element of psych out factor for Donald Trump not liking someone against him who he has rubbed elbows with for decades.
John on Twitter says that, who is a self-identified sort of moderate or a centrist, but sort of leans conservative on most political issues, says that he registered as a Democrat so he could vote for Bloomberg. And the only two Democrats that would make him vote for Trump are Sanders and Warren. Patrick?
He lives in New York.
We have listeners as far away as Vancouver, my man.
No, I know, but I just... You know, my calculus is that Sanders, or, you know, a lefty presidential nomination brings a lot of non-voters into the fold. You know, the people that, and that was one of the things that really hurt Hillary in 2016 was the, you know, the incredible drop in turnout among young people and just, you know, sort of people that burned out of politics. And I think you've got to run as a hope and change candidate, you know, as the system is broken and here's how I want to fix it for you. And I think those two just have a better shot at that than the rest of the field who's, you know, who they're just like, yeah, no, the system is mostly working okay, but here's a few minor tweaks.
So you're not feeling a Klobuchar?
You love Klobuchar so much.
No, I like the term Klobuchar because I think I came up with it first, and I'm wondering if I can profit from it. I don't know that it's going to happen.
It's just like you think, you know, what's Klobuchar's signature proposal? Oh, we're going to let people refinance their student loans. You know, the 25-year-old is just going to be
moderate tweaking of student loans doesn't light you up?
No, it's just people are just going to be like sprinting to, crawling over broken glass of the ballot box to move that interest rate from 6 to 4.5 on their $50,000 student debt.
Okay, so maybe there won't be a Klobuchar. We'll see. It's too early to say.
Klobentum.
Nobody who claims they know exactly what's going to happen in the next several months, don't believe them. Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hey, about that discussion about states like Iowa and New Hampshire and, you know, the feeling that they should be relegated to the dustbin of history and as far as choosing political candidates, I think the one reason that the smaller states are up front is to allow a candidate to kind of gain some steam or some wind in their sails and not have to embark on, 24 months of fundraising to you know, attack a bigger state like California or New York right off the bat. So I think that that was the concept behind this. As far as Iowa is concerned, I think they should just turn it into a primary and get rid of this caucus thing, whatever the heck this is. I don't get it. It just seems kind of goofy, goofy to kind of not be able to report the results within a few hours of the event taking place. But one other point about Bloomberg is that I was in New York City about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and they are just peppering the streets with people trying to get him on the ballot.
Yeah. Robert, thank you. So a couple of points there. We'll work backwards. I mean, he's got enough money that, you know, he'll play in as many states as he needs to be viable. If, I mean, I don't know all of the things that will factor into whether he gets momentum or not, but money is a big part of it. He will have the operation. Yeah,
that's the one positive thing I will say about Bloomberg is he's got a huge staff. He's paying them crazy money, and he said that no matter what, he's going to keep them all around until the general election, no matter who's the nominee.
That means a lot to someone like you.
It does.
Honestly.
Yeah. No, he's you know, he's paying well above market rate for organizers, for canvassers, for, you know, almost every aspect of his campaign. And, you know, he's got the promise of, you know, guaranteed labor. You know, you're not going to have that poor soul who moved to Iowa 3 days before Harris dropped out, you know.
Right, right. And but let's kind of like hit that point on why we do the states this way. I think Robert's making a fair point here. If you are not a big money candidate like Bloomberg, and the first state on the list is California, that's a hard thing to do. Whereas, yes, I get it, in a smaller state, you can gain more traction. Do you have a problem with that?
Is anybody not a big money candidate in 2019, though? Like, everyone has huge money, regardless of whether it's coming, you know, from, you know, rubber chicken dinners or, you know, $28 donations.
No. You're the guy, the Sanders and Warren guy, saying that everybody's big money candidate?
I'm saying, like, all, like, to be viable in a presidential race, you have to raise a ton of money, not that
the donations themselves.
Sorry. Yeah.
But the point is, you don't want to spend it all right off the bat, because if you have to blow your wad on California, then it's very hard to play in the other states. And I see, and I think that was a point that Jeremy and I both made about not wanting to have a national rollout, because even if California and New York had been the first states, Obama wouldn't have made it through in 2008. He would have blown his wad immediately. But there are states who I think are more representative and more manageable than Iowa and New Hampshire to begin.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think there's also some in between California, right, and Iowa, right? I think there's something that meets the smaller geographic footprint that you can get around in a bus, right, and actually get around in a couple hours, but that it's more diverse. I mean, I really, it drives me nuts that we're having a conversation about really important structural issues of racism in this country with people who don't have to live that life every day in Iowa, right? And I don't want to wait till South Carolina. I want to have that conversation right now. And I don't want to lose a really talented mind who's thoughtful and bold and courageous about tackling some of these inequities that have existed in our system for years. Right. But because they didn't make it through the first two states, they lost their momentum.
And it's not just race. You're talking about two states that don't have as big of a threat to the impacts of, say, climate change. There's no coastline in Iowa. New Hampshire has a very, very, very small coastline. States that aren't impacted by hurricanes, states that don't have a lot of the industry that we see in other parts of the country.
Yeah. And by the way, that point about who makes it out of Iowa, New Hampshire is fascinating. I mean, I was waiting for the Huntsman charge in the Republican primaries. That never happened. And
right.
If only John Huntsman had been top three in Iowa or New Hampshire, you could have got a ticket out. Why do we do this ticket out thing? Even the Warren campaign's talking about, we've got the third ticket out of Iowa. What is a ticket out of Iowa? Why do we do this?
It's 5 minutes at 9 p.m. on MSNBC. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Right? It's a talking point that pundits like to say. We can get nostalgic about, oh, do you remember when Obama won? And, you know, we can talk about that, right? And it justifies our feeling of, okay, there's momentum, right? There's momentum, that magic word of momentum, right? And again, I think that there are so many, we are fortunate as a Democratic Party to have great candidates who are running. And by the way, our bench is way stronger than the other side. Way stronger. We have not seen the end of Kamala Harris or Cory Booker. They're going to do great work in the U.S. Senate, and I'm glad that they're there. But I will say that we have to stop eliminating people, again, for not having this arbitrary ticket out of.
Well, even Joe Biden, I heard an analyst last night say, if Biden really does come in fourth or fifth, his whole premise is electability. What does this say? Well, what this says is, this is a state he hasn't performed well in the past. It's way younger in terms of voting in the caucuses than a lot of other states, and Biden obviously performs well in the 65 and older crowd. It's not all that representative, and there's no Republicans or independents voting. So it doesn't actually say anything about November. I don't know why we get hung up on, I'm not defending Joe Biden as a candidate saying you should or shouldn't vote for him, but that was just a bad analysis. And we overanalyze these small states as if we have to declare whether candidates are in or out anymore. But we do it every time.
I think Joe Biden does sort of present as the guy who can unify the Democratic Party, though. I think it's
he presents more as the guy who can unify everybody.
But the first step to that is unifying the Democratic Party.
I think his assumption is whoever the candidate is will get that party unified out of necessity. Yeah. Then he can bridge and unify more, I would think. You got an issue with that, Jen Lunsford?
No. That's I agree.
Okay. All right. Well, let me get another phone call. Dan in Brighton wants to defend caucuses. All right, Dan, you're up.
I'm from Minnesota. The caucuses were a lot of fun. I agree that probably should not be used for choosing presidential candidates. Should have a primary and a caucus, because in the caucus you hash out other issues and you learn about who's playing politics in your locality. And one of my caucuses, I actually met a gal who later became the wife of the senator. It was really a lot of fun to meet people and hash out issues. And in some ways, all the nuts came out of the woodwork, but that was fun too. I'll hang up and listen to your reply.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. Does that sway you?
That sounds like a great party for the Sunday before the primary. You can attend in your own free time because that's the thing you're interested in doing.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, we have more forums now than existed before to have those types of conversations, whether it's an electronic forum through social media or whether it's, you know, individual house parties and, you know, real kind of dialogues within different types of communities. I don't think we necessarily need to devote our next presidential contest. And by the way, I think I read someplace last night that it was $50 million that was spent on average in Iowa. $50 million, right? I mean, I'll get on my soapbox with too much money in politics, but that is not representative of how we need to be allocating resources in this country. And certainly, again, trying to get more candidates involved in the process is a barrier. If it's Iowa and we're dropping $50 million in it, imagine what it's like in New York and California.
All right, one more point before we close the hour. If you look at the actual participation numbers last night in Iowa, they were roughly the same as 2016. It wasn't anything special. It wasn't a spike. We didn't see a Democratic surge in participation. Iowa's biggest number by far was 2008, and it hasn't been approached since then. So I'm sure there is enthusiasm on both sides of this election, and I'm sure Democrats have a lot of enthusiasm. It didn't manifest. And I think part of that is, it's just, as Jen said, I mean, as really as the whole panel's pointed out, this is not a process, a caucusing process, that really lends itself. When you are concerned enough about voting days and early voting and different options for people, let alone, forget caucuses, hours upon ends caucusing at one set time. Are you concerned, though, briefly here, the turnout last night, does it mean anything about Democratic enthusiasm? Anything to concern you, or do you think one state early, way too early to draw any conclusions?
Yes and no. Iowa, you know, is very unlikely to be a tipping state. You know, I mean, even if the Democratic nominee, whoever it is competitive in Iowa, they're probably going to win no matter what, you know, based on the partisan leans of the swing states. But I think there's definitely cause to be worried the turnout is stable for 16, especially for the candidates, you know, who have pitched, you know, made it a significant part of their pitch that, you know, they're the people who can get non-voters engaged in the political process.
Like Sanders.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think if we're trying to read into turnout for the general versus the primary, I don't think I'm concerned at all. I think there's a lot of people. This is an enormous field. People are exhausted. And unless you're really psyched about one particular candidate, I know people who are like, I can't decide. I don't care. I want to vote for the Democrat. And whoever comes out the other end is good enough for me. So they'll show up in November, even if they don't show up now.
Okay, Jeremy?
I'd be curious to know the population trends from 2008 to now in the state of Iowa. But not knowing that, I agree that this is not reflective of the general election. That said, again, 11 great Democratic candidates, and they've been working the phones and knocking on doors. I'd like to see a bigger turnout if you really feel moved. Maybe Democrats are not hearing the message that they need to hear.
All right, last minute, and we're gonna play this tape back in 4 years. Ready for this? Which state votes first in 2024?
Hawaii. I think it's going to be a journalist conspiracy. They're all going to, you know, journalists and party power brokers.
The door is open now. Yeah, we can do whatever you want.
They're going to get together.
All right, that's funny, but who do you think it's going to be?
No idea. Maybe Nevada.
Okay.
Iowa, because we learned nothing.
That's a better answer.
That's inertia is still the most likely outcome. Jeremy?
I would say definitely South Dakota, not North Dakota. No, I'm just kidding. I would say Florida. I mean, let's get Florida out of the way.
No. Everybody thinks Iowa should go last now. Iowa should go 49th. Florida should always go last for what they have. Florida guy has earned enough to go last, in at least for the next century. But I'm going to say Iowa first, no caucuses anymore. We'll see. I wouldn't be surprised if New Hampshire goes first. I wouldn't be surprised if Nevada, South Carolina, those early states sort of move up.
What about New York?
No.
We need some state senators to get on that. Move the primary date up.
On it.
Jeremy Cooney is a former chief of staff for the city of Rochester and a Democratic candidate for the 56th Senate District. He is going to be in a primary. You will hear from his opponent on this program in days to come, offering her takes as well. Thanks for being here. Always nice to have you.
Thank you, Evan.
Jen Lunsford is an attorney with Seeger Sorrentino and a candidate for the 135th Assembly District. As always, nice having you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Patrick Coyle is a grad student and a political operative. Nice having you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Short break. More connections coming up.